The Tom Woods Show, episode 1621.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're considering homeschooling, you know I recommend the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, for which I created 400 videos. It's an excellent education in all the standard subjects, plus personal finance for teens, how to be an effective public speaker, how to run a home business, the kinds of things nobody teaches, but they darn well should. Not to mention, it's self-taught, so you get your sanity back as a parent. Make sure you join at my special link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses you can't get anywhere else. Check it out at ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to be sharing with you today an appearance I made recently on the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, hosted by our friend Pete Quinones. Now, you may know him under his pseudonym Mance Raider, which he used for a long time. You probably know the origin of that name. And now he's using his real name, Pete Quinones. And he's got a great podcast. A lot of you, I think, listen to it. I appeared alongside Michael Bolden, who, of course, was the very first guest ever on the Tom Woods Show, episode number one. So all three of us are talking. Pete wanted to talk about state nullification and its application in current circumstances, but also in general, what the idea is all about. And the old man here wrote a book on that called Nullification, and it teaches you a lot of American history that nobody else teaches you. And if you're thinking to yourself, I just don't like reading physical books, I just don't like turning pages, I don't even like Kindle, you can get the audiobook version for free when you sign up at TomWoodsAudio.com. You can pick any audiobook you want for free, and you might as well do that. And then it's if you never subscribed to Audible before, and then if you decide you don't want to stick with Audible, you just tell them I don't want to stick with it, and you get to keep your free book. So why would you not do that? So TomWoodsAudio.com is where to go for that. And here we go. I hope you enjoy our discussion.
Tom, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Pete. Thanks for having me.
Michael, how are you?
I mean, I'm in central California, so I'm as good as can be under the circumstances.
I could just imagine you being locked down in Gestapo-type tactics.
Dude,
right now.
The closest I can explain, it's eerie here in L.A. It's not crazy yet, but it's eerie to the point of it reminds me of the first time I was spent time in L.A., which was literally 3 weeks after the L.A. riots. I've just not seen burned out gas stations yet.
Wow. Wow, I can't imagine. It hasn't happened around here yet, but you never know. When they start suspending government services, that's when I'll know things are bad around here, because they never suspend government services around here. Anyway, gentlemen, I wanted to have a conversation today about nullification and secession. I think this is a great time in history to talk about it, but I think people need a little bit of history first. Tom, since you wrote the book on it, fantastic book. Thank you very much for writing it. I guess the way I'll start it is to ask, you mention in there, there's the phrase, the spirit of 98. So can you give an elevator pitch kind of, you know, little explanation of what that means and where nullification came from historically?
The spirit of 98 refers to the documents known as the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. Which passed those legislatures at a time when the federal government was cracking down on, among other things, the freedom of speech. And those states were making clear that it was within their rights to refuse to go along with that. And the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and then the follow-up ones of 1799 have Thomas Jefferson's fingerprints all over them. And I think those resolutions are really the best statement we have of what's known as the compact theory of the Union, that the United States began as a collection of states, not as a single whole, but as a collection of states that for their mutual security and benefit decided to delegate some of their powers to a central government. But they still remain just as sovereign as they were before. The peoples of those states were just as sovereign as they were before. And obviously, since they are the creators of this new government, and this new government is merely their agent, the agent doesn't have more power than the originator. So the states can defend themselves should it become necessary if their agent goes beyond what's been delegated to it. So the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions were not at that time viewed very favorably by the other states, let's say, because in New England, for example, there were some states that issued resolutions of their own condemning what Virginia and Kentucky had said. But when you look more closely, you find that in all these cases, the states doing this themselves supported the federal government's crackdown on free speech. So it wasn't really so much that they were appalled by the constitutional theories of Virginia and Kentucky. They were appalled that Virginia and Kentucky were uppity enough to tell the federal government to go jump in a lake. And we know this because not 10 years later, these very states that were oh so appalled at Virginia and Kentucky, when the shoe was on the other foot and things were being done to them that they didn't like, namely an embargo being placed on their trade, well, all of a sudden, guess what they discovered? The spirit of 98. They discovered the principles whereby a state could refuse to enforce an unconstitutional federal law. So this term, the spirit of 98, was known by everyone all over the country in the early 19th century, and it reflected an understanding whereby, in the last resort, the states had, in effect, a veto power they could exercise because, after all, they created this thing. And the Frankenstein monster is supposed to take dictation from Dr. Frankenstein.
Michael, I'm going to ask you about how northern states used this to nullify the Fugitive Slave Act. Tom's written about it extensively, but I've heard you talk about it before. Why don't you talk a little bit about just what the Fugitive Slave Act was? And the reason I'm bringing this up is so many people want to relate this subject, and Tom spends a whole chapter in his book, knocking it down, that this is all about slavery. People were using nullification because, northern states wanted, the federal government wanted southern states to end slavery. But really, when you look at nullification and the 10th Amendment in general, a good example of how it was used for good was nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I think we should probably just back up just briefly and understand. So I'm going to continue to defer to Tom on the historical basis on all this. But where I can come in with some expertise, I think, is on strategy and implementation. So when I've studied the history and the application of it, that's where I think I've learned the most. And for example, James Madison, when he was still pushing for centralized power before the Constitution was ratified, he sent a letter just before the convention started in Philadelphia to George Washington, saying that is in his plan, what he wanted was to have a national negative in all cases whatsoever, basically a national veto power over the states, because he recognized that under a federal type structure, and he called it a defensive power to have a national veto to Washington, he said every power put on paper would be, quote, evaded and defeated by the states. He recognized back then, before the Constitution was even drafted in Philadelphia, that states would have significant power to defeat and undermine federal programs. Well, for whatever reason, he changed to the other side. I'm not even going to speculate on his reasons. Maybe he was a pragmatist. But when he was writing in Federalist 46, arguing in favor of ratification, primarily to a New York audience, he recommended four main steps to undermine and defeat federal programs, one being a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. So as Tom put it just a moment ago, he was talking about how states would not enforce laws that they see as unconstitutional. And Madison even said this could be used for warrantable federal acts, those that were constitutional but just bad policy. So at a time when the government was going to be completely tiny in comparison today, Madison and others recognized that states were very powerful to defeat those federal programs by merely not participating. So today, in an environment we live in today, when the federal government tells us what size of toilet we can have, what kind of light bulbs we can have, what kind of plant we can grow and consume in our backyard, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union is even far more effective to defeat these federal programs. Now, regarding personal liberty laws, that's basically what they put into practice in northern states throughout the country. They basically said they weren't going to participate in the enforcement of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And some states actually went so far like in Ohio, they made deals where they arrested some federal agents and then they had to work it out. But like the state resistance was incredibly effective. And in the South Carolina Declaration of Causes, when they filed that paperwork along with their ordinance of secession, they specifically complained about how effective these northern states were at refusing to implement and nullifying the Federal Fugitive Slave Act.
Now, do you think that the reason why more states aren't more apt to use it today is just ignorance? There are some people that just don't even really realize that it exists. Or is it that this, some of the states have just become too reliant on the federal government to, you know, want to push back and step on any toes?
Well, I think it's because the idea of the states doing anything has been rendered toxic in the minds of anybody who's sat in an American classroom for the past 70 years. So if you even so much as mention the states, people want to ascribe bad motives to you. Even though the history of nullification is a fairly honorable one, and if you were to say, ah, but there have been people who threatened to nullify over, you know, let's say, whatever, desegregation or something. Yeah, but the federal government itself has been terrible on those issues. So it's not like that's uniquely our problem. The federal government was there. The federal government was upholding slavery. The federal government was upholding segregation. Nullification at least can say that it was never used on behalf of slavery. So that's something on our side. But I think it's that. I think also it's that federal judges and lawyers are trained in a tradition of constitutional law that excludes the possibility of nullification. In the very way they explain the Constitution, it's excluded. Because the Constitution is explained through the exegesis of people like John Marshall and Joseph Story, who look at the Union as a single indivisible whole. And if that's the case, then the states may exist for the sake of the convenience of the central government, but they don't have powers of their own that they reserve, including a power of resistance. They are administrative units of the center. So it's inconceivable in that model. It's actually inconceivable that the states could have a power of nullification. So therefore, anybody advocating it must be crazy. They're not even worth talking about. But this is really a case of the victors write the history books, because the case for the compact theory versus the nationalist theory is absolutely overwhelming and airtight. And there's a whole chapter, I think that, if I may say so, the chapter in my book Nullification on the compact versus the nationalist theories is probably the best short treatment you're going to get. You can read a 150-page to 200-page treatment, but I think it's probably the best short treatment you can get. In fact, I don't think there was an attempt, even an attempt to lay out the nationalist theory until the 1830s. I don't think anybody even tried it, whereas you can see the compact theory already in 1798. You can see it strongly implied by Patrick Henry earlier than that, John Taylor of Caroline also in the 1790s, St. George Tucker in the very early 19th century. You see this over and over and over. So I think that's the main problem.
Well, Michael, we know that some localities, even states, have fought against it, even fought against federal overreach in the last 20 years. So can you give us a good example of where they used nullification without, maybe they didn't even know they were doing it?
Yeah, and that makes me think of Rothbard's great work, Conceived in Liberty. And I can't remember where, one of you guys probably know better than me, but I remember reading through this and they were talking about a revolutionary act or a series of acts in Virginia, where all these different groups with different interests were kind of all ended up being on the same side, even though they had different goals. So what I learned, at least from reading Rothbard, is you may end up on the right side, even if your goal isn't in the right place. You may not think of it in the same way we do as nullification. And one could look to marijuana as probably the greatest example, maybe in history. We're now at 33 states that are literally flat out defying Washington, D.C.'s total prohibition on a plant. They say in the Supreme Court, in the 2005 Gonzalez versus Raich case, every level of the executive branch says you cannot do this. The Federal Reserve even helps enforce federal marijuana prohibition by sending threatening letters to any credit unions or banks that try to do business with people that conduct business and want to deposit money into the Federal Reserve system. So even though the feds are all over there, so they want to be, there's not much they can do to stop it when enough people, when enough cities and enough states merely say no to them and legalize what the federal government claims the power to prohibit anyways. I think we should apply this to just about everything.
Well, considering we are recording this on March 18th, 2010, and all anybody can talk about is the coronavirus, do either of you remember a time where there is just a really weird feeling in the society, even just talking to people? Do you remember anything else like this?
No, not me. Not at all. It's just weird. It's eerie. Like I was saying right at the outset, it is here in LA. It's eerie when I know I can drive from downtown Los Angeles to Santa Monica, 18 miles away, in 22 minutes in rush hour on the 10 freeway, one of the busiest in the world, instead of an hour and a half. It's just weird. People are hiding out and there's helicopters swirling over. It just feels strange.
Tom, you're in a small town. What's it like down there?
Well, I haven't really ventured out all that much. I don't really even want to say where, because
I know
the particular part of Florida I live is like an armpit in between two nice places. And there's a specific reason I live here. And it's like I have the nicest house in this area, but that's not saying much. But I think the people around me are the last ones in the world to finally adapt to anything. So I have seen them kind of going about their business, but it is still reduced, that's for sure. And things are being canceled. And there was even a thing I was going to go to later this week, which is called the Central Florida Metal Fest. And up till about 5 days ago, they were still saying, yeah, you know, we're metal people. We don't get viruses. Like it was some kind of crazy stuff like that. Like we don't have to worry about this, right? You know, maybe somebody going to hear James Taylor has to worry about the coronavirus, not us. And even they had to finally say, all right, for heaven's sake, I guess we're going to cancel that. So pretty much everything's been shut down. And the thing is, I even had on my calendar, March 13th, tickets go on sale for, I like when Broadway shows travel around the country. Tickets were going on sale for A Bronx Tale, which is one of my favorites. And it's going to be performed next month. But now who even knows? Right? And these traveling shows, what are they supposed to do? They must be just sitting around wondering, do we just stay still and cancel some shows and hope that others go on? So I don't even know what to do. But basically, despite the people, things have been shut down. But my understanding is that if you drive around and you look at bowling alleys and stuff, they're still fuller than they ought to be in light of the situation.
You just mentioned one of my favorite movies, too. I would love to see a stage
adaptation.
Oh,
the Broadway version is fantastic. Is it absolutely real? Fantastic. And the thing is, this is what happens every time I have Gene Epstein on my show. We get on these side conversations on Broadway shows. So cool. Let's take this up later.
Okay. All right. So I want to talk about all these threats that have come down. Yeah, I mean, and I've seen a lot of stuff inside states, too. Like, how would nullification be handled inside a state? Like, Massachusetts is saying if there are more than 10 people in a gathering, that's illegal at this point. I mean, and, you know, whenever they say illegal, that means gun points it at you.
Man, San Francisco, as of this week, there's about in the Bay Area, there's about 8 million people on a close to lockdown. I saw that the governor of New Jersey is instituting a curfew as of yesterday. It's a voluntary curfew from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. And then he literally hinted, he's like, well, we'll see how it plays out. So the threats are pretty intense. What I thought was interesting, though, when I was listening to Brian McClanahan early this week talking about the ability to do quarantines and things like this, and he was basically saying, like, look, we're looking at the governor of Florida, DeSantis. He's basically begging the federal government to come in and shut down air travel. Well, whether you agree with or disagree with the idea of shutting down airports, McClanahan made such a good point. He's basically like, stop asking the federal government and start doing it, whether the federal government wants you to or not. And that's what Tom was talking about in regards to the spirit of 98. It's taking a position of what you believe in, what you think is right in your own area, regardless of what the rest of the country is going to do.
Do you have anything to say on that, Tom?
Well, my thinking is that given that nullification is you know, as I say, it's toxic in the minds of people. Either that or they don't know anything about it at all. But I think for a lot of people, it's toxic. Then you explain to them, but wait a minute, I'm sure you approve of what this state or that state did when it came to medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, that sort of thing. And I'm sure you approve of what states were trying to do with right to try laws and things like that, you know, for trying life-saving drugs, potentially life-saving drugs that the FDA hadn't approved, things like that. They'll say, well, yeah, I guess I do approve of that. So you can detoxify it to some degree. But I wonder if in the midst of a crisis where the country is deeply divided as to what the right thing to do is, I don't know. I mean, I would be interested to get Michael's thoughts as to whether now is the best time to try to unroll and try to roll out an idea that's toxic in most people's minds, that has an unjustifiably bad reputation, that all the judges and all the lawyers are against. You would need massive public support in order to make work. I don't know that now is that time. Whereas with stuff like legalizing marijuana, there's a lot of public support for that, you know, and a whole lot that you could mobilize. And you have a federal government that's only half-heartedly interested. Here you have a federal government that is deeply, like deathly interested in what's going on in the states. I'm sorry, I don't mean to take over the host role here, Pete, but do you mind if I ask Michael for his thoughts on that particular point?
Please do.
Yeah, it's tough. And in some ways, I'm actually more concerned about draconian measures coming from the state governments than I am personally about what. I mean, to me, all governments are very frightening because when they're backed up into a corner, they get incredibly aggressive and they've got tons of firepower. So they make me nervous. But in many ways, it's the state governments because in essence, the police power is reserved to the states. They can kind of go to town and get away with it even easier than Washington, D.C. can, primarily because the feds are so low on manpower to try to implement anything across the entire country. And then, of course, when you have a population, Tom, you were basically mentioning this too, when people are freaked out and then so politically divided, I think people are very willing to just kind of throw everything out the window, whether they believe something is right.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you're right about that. You know, and I was talking to Peter Schiff just this morning because for the Tom Woods Show, I wanted to have him on to talk about the economic ramifications of all this. And he was saying, well, obviously Joe Biden's going to be our next president. Because the way that came up was Bernie Sanders got raised. And he said, well, obviously Bernie's not going to be the next president. Joe Biden is. And I asked him, do you mean Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee? Or do you mean he's going to be the next president? He said, oh, he's going to be the next president. And I said, I've heard a lot of people say Trump's going to lose because of what's happening right now. But the way I was thinking about it was, suppose this thing kind of blows over in the next month or two. Trump could then rally his people by saying, look, anybody else on the debate stage with me would have been too afraid of political correctness to shut down immigration from China temporarily or movement of peoples from China. They would have been too afraid. You know that I'm not afraid, and I did it, and I saved people's lives. He could do that. And meanwhile, the things that are annoying most people, as you say, Michael, are happening on the state level. It's their mayors, it's their governors they're upset at. So maybe Trump could still pull this thing out. And Schiff's response was, generally the way people think is when you have a ship that's going down, the captain takes the blame. And he says, you just don't have a case of a person getting reelected during a recession. So he thinks, you know, so much the worse for Trump. But my point is that you're right, that I think the things that are being done that will, even though they're all doing bad things, but the things that are most hurting people in the pocketbook and scaring people are being done at the state level. And meanwhile, Trump's planning to hand everybody a $2,000 check.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Schiff has been talking about this for quite a while, too. I've been listening to his podcast pretty regularly, but he's been saying, hey, if this recession hits, Trump is toast one way or the other. This is well before the virus situation got out of hand. And certainly if you're experiencing local draconian measures, that's going to be like you're going to blame that. Whether the funding comes from Washington, D.C. or the directives come from Washington, D.C., my friends up in San Francisco are freaked out right now because everything is being shut down. And then those who have to go to work, they're scared because the streets are empty minus some shady characters all over the place. And their first thought is the mayor or Newsom, the governor. And of course, those people are awful. But certainly, yeah, I don't know how it's going to – I can't make any predictions, but it's a crazy time we're living in.
So it looks like recently some people are actually saying that libertarianism has won because you mentioned an article that the New York Times writer wrote the other day. I mean, I've seen people on social media actually say, and these are people who normally wouldn't say this, that there's too much deregulation. There's too much regulation. If there was more deregulation, so many, you know, we could have test kits out there already. I mean, do you think that this is an opportunity right now that we could show people that libertarianism could win, you know, is the way to go, and that nullification and even secession is a good idea? Look, these people can't handle this, but, you know, maybe if we were smaller, we could.
Yeah, I think that is I think right now you have a really, really unwieldy big thing trying to micromanage a major problem. And I think it seems more likely that people on the ground close to different situations would have a sense of what makes sense best here and what makes sense best over there. I mean, obviously, the middle of Iowa is very different from downtown Manhattan, and it doesn't seem sensible that you would want to have the same response in the middle of Iowa that you have in downtown Manhattan. So this does seem tailor-made for the idea that a more local response tailored to particular needs and circumstances is what's called for.
How do you think that would work, Michael?
Well, you know, of all people, Governor Cuomo in New York late last week or early this week specifically said we need to decentralize this whole situation. And when I tweeted that out, because I'm like, man, this is probably the first time that dude has ever said decentralized for anything. So, I mean, this is me just being a positive person looking for a glimmer of hope. I hear here in Los Angeles, they've cut down arrests from, you know, like 300 to 500 a day to like 60. They're just prioritizing on violence, which, you know, if we're thinking non-aggression principle, and if you're going to have cops, maybe that's all they should do is deal with violent actions. They're not giving out tickets. I just saw that the federal government is going to ease regulations so doctors can perform activities across state lines. Why weren't they able to do that in the first place? And then will people potentially learn, oh, wow, well, maybe it's okay for a doctor from Oklahoma to go to Kansas and do some work because it's a doctor and that person's good at what they do. So I don't know if people will take this as a learning example in the long run or not. My hope is some people do, and we'll see how it plays out.
It seemed like the last holdout on this of we're not going to – all of these recommendations are being made about not having crowds and everything. Disney World, of all places, was like the last holdout. It's like they closed, I think, of yesterday, and they were – you know, normal operations and everything. And now they've just announced that they're going to close through the end of the month. So, you know, a lot of times we'll use Disney World as like an example of, hey, you know, this is how anarchy could work, own police force. They, you know, their own property basically. But, yeah, they finally caved yesterday. I know Disneyland caved 2 weeks ago, Mike.
Basically everything in this area has been just caved for quite a while. And, you know, in a weird way, sometimes I kind of like hiding away from crowds around here anyway, so it's a blessing in disguise.
Well, and maybe, just maybe, people are going to learn by this, because I think I was reading this morning that they're going to delay tax. They're going to push the tax date out from the April 15th, 2 months or 3 months.
Yeah, 3 months. But at the same time, we're also hearing that they're reactivating what the Defense Production Act is. And now, I don't know for sure, but I believe that's what Truman used to try to nationalize the steel industry. One of you guys probably knows that history better than I do. But I think we're just at the cusp, the very beginning of what government will try to do. So it really remains to be seen.
If the federal government came down with something just... say they came down with a national curfew, how would you see that playing out? And who do you think, from your knowledge of, you know, Michael, especially you follow all the nullification movements all over the country. Who do you think would just be like, no, and be the first ones to jump at no and push back against that?
Well, I think a lot of people are just voluntarily doing this already anyways. I mean, there just aren't people out. So is government doing one of these things like when they did child labor laws? I mean, kids were already not working, right? It might be one of those situations, and maybe I'm more hopeful of that. But what I do know for a fact is the feds, even though they're very big and powerful with lots of guns and lots of fiat currency, they don't have the manpower to enforce all their stuff, not even close. So, for example, the ATF has somewhere around 5,100 employees for the entire country. A third of those are in administration, you know, just answering phones or sitting around wasting people's money. And the rest of them do enforcement. And they can only close between 8,000 and 10,000 federal gun charge cases per year. So what does that mean if a lot of people decide to not participate, or if localities or states say, you know, what's right for California is certainly isn't the right path for Missouri? I don't think the feds will be able to do a lot about it if people decide that they don't want to go along.
Tom, do you think looking at the way people have basically took it upon themselves to stay home, to you know, just not be social, that we can use this as a good example and argument for people for that society would be self-order? The society can be self-ordering without, you know, people with guns telling us what to do.
Well, Pete Earl, I think it's his name, over at AIER has a pretty good piece out, I think just today, on South Korea. Now, obviously, South Korea has done some things that would make some civil libertarians balk, let's say. But they haven't shut down the whole country. They haven't gone to the extreme measures that we've seen in some places. And they've actually had pretty good results. So that would be a good example to look at. At the same time, even, and I'm just thinking out loud here, and the trouble I find in communities like ours where we're deeply ideological, it's not just libertarians, but deeply ideological people, is that when you think out loud and you're just trying to understand something complicated and you say something that might be 30% different from what they expect you to say, you get emails saying, I'm never listening to you again. You're the worst person in the world. I'm going to quote this one sentence you said for the next 40 years to sum up your career. You know, so I feel like I'm in that position right now. But I am kind of wondering, what about the situation where there are a lot of stupid people who, no matter how much you say to them, they say, oh, look, I've had the flu before. Or, you know, I heard, you know, I lived through Hurricane Matthew or whatever. None of these things are relevant to the discussion at all. None. Like in Florida, you get a lot of hurricane warnings that don't come to pass. And so then people say, well, you know, I guess I don't have to pay any attention to hurricane warnings. But that doesn't follow. And it leads to a bunch of people who think, well, I'm a tough guy. I've toughed out a lot of other things. I'm going to tough this out. I think we do have a lot of people who won't do the right thing unless they're forced to do it. And I genuinely am trying to think of what the libertarian answer to that is.
Is it private property?
Well, it couldn't hurt, but I'm yes, of course. But right now, if we're not in NCAPistan, what's the short term solution? I mean, is it if we really are now? I know people will say, "Oh, they're exaggerating the numbers." Maybe they are. I just published something by Richard Epstein. I linked to it on Twitter. I linked to it in my email newsletter that has a much more optimistic look at the numbers. But let's say the numbers are as drastic and frightening as they say. My question to myself would be, in that situation, when there is a major risk to a large population, major, major risk that could not just the people who would get it, but the people who have other problems, like you get into a car accident, there's no ICU bed for you. So it's not just, oh, I don't have to worry about it because I'm not 78 years old. But if a 78-year-old person is taking up that bed that you need when you're in a car accident, it is your problem. I ask myself, in that situation, which is more important to me, trying to prevent a complete collapse of the medical system, which, you know, and many, many, many lives lost, or being the world's greatest libertarian? You know, I ask myself that question. I'm not sure what the answer is.
I don't think any of us honestly really know. I appreciate you sharing that too, Tom. And that's, I just kind of go back to what Brian McClanahan has been saying. Basically, these types of decisions in order really to be effective and to give liberty a chance to still have the door open really has to be decentralized. I mean, we can look to Hoppe and talk about 1,000 independent city states if we really want to get as close to Ancapistan as possible. But even if it's on a state by state level, I think that has significant impact. So if you don't want to be in a draconian state like California, maybe you can go to a different type of draconian state like Utah. I mean, they're all bad to some degree. But of course, responding to issues in each area has got to be different. And I certainly expect, as you know, as they're giving these voluntary shut-in orders, if people don't, like, this is basically what happened in Chicago. People, the weekend before St. Patrick's Day, you know, the mayor's basically telling people don't go out and be in crowds, and then the bars are packed and people are sharing drinks and stuff like that. People are, in an essence, we don't know what's really going on. So I would think that's pretty stupid, and a lot of the population is being really stupid in this situation, and all that's going to do is encourage the hammer of government to come in and do something about it.
You make a great point, though. You know, I like to talk a lot about police abuse, but you really, if you get down to people who like live in Iowa or something and they live in a really small town, they may have gone to, you know, school with the whole police department. So they know everybody like that. But yeah, I mean, the smaller you get, the more people can talk to each other, the more people can come to a consensus. I mean, they don't have to vote. They just have to be, yeah, that's a really good idea. But the bigger you get, you know, on the coasts, I mean, the town I live in used to be part of Atlanta. That's how close I am to Atlanta. And getting a consensus on anything here is, you might as well just go to the 202 area code because it's just going to be bureaucratic. I mean, there's going to be no consensus whatsoever. There's just going to be one person whose only qualification is they got elected to make these decisions. So, yeah, I mean, I think specialization is another thing too, you know, and I live 5 miles from the CDC, you know, and there's like no one, and even on the local news around here, there's like not any really good recommendations for what to do in this case.
Yeah, and none of us should really trust government. That doesn't mean, I think, none of us trust government. None of us trust politicians. None of us trust bureaucrats. They're all really self-interested. That doesn't mean necessarily that their warnings are wrong. Maybe they're not warning enough. Maybe they're warning too much. And that's why I think we need to keep looking to other sources, to our neighbors, to our communities and family about how to take care of ourselves the best. And personally, I'm just avoiding as much interaction with people I don't know as possible.
Well, also, I've found that some of the people who follow me, and I like these people. They're not saying they're bad people, but I think some of them follow me because they're naturally contrarians, and I'm not really naturally a contrarian. Like, so, it's, for example, I don't go around saying Beethoven is totally overrated. He was a bum, because that would be contrarian. Or John Locke had nothing to say about liberty. That would be contrarian. I'm not naturally contrarian. I'm contrarian only against wrong, evil people. Period. But I have some people who just, whatever the conventional wisdom is, it's just wrong. It's wrong because they found somebody on a website that looks like it was built in 1997 by a 10-year-old says that it's wrong. And so I get all this anti-conventional wisdom stuff on all kinds of topics that you can possibly imagine all the time. And that's just not who I am. It's not to say that I always blindly trust every authority. I do have some kind of healthy skepticism, but I don't think that just because a government official says something that it's automatically wrong. Now, a lot of times because they lie so much with government, yeah, I kind of do assume that, but not every institution and even not even government, because sometimes if they say, hey, this building is on fire and I'm standing outside the building and I see the flames, I know they're telling me the truth on that. Sometimes they are telling the truth. So, but yet I have so many people saying, well, if the government tells me X, that's enough for me to believe Y. That's not a scientific frame of mind at all. And it can be very unhelpful. And also it, frankly, makes us look bad.
Yeah, where I'm really skeptical on government is, for example, the FDA. Actually, 3-4 days ago, I'm talking to my sister, and she says, "Oh, the New York Times said don't worry about the food supply. The shelves are just empty. There's no problems with a food shortage." And then I saw it in another paper a day later, and then I think it was yesterday, the FDA said, "Don't worry about the food supply." It's like a coordinated, similar message. It just no one should stock up for more than a week. Now, in that kind of situation, I'm like, are you just trying to calm us down because people are really worked up? And then I want to buy more food to have on hand. But in general, Tom, I think I agree with you as well. The idea of rejecting everything just because it's government is not smart. In fact, it can be dangerous. It makes the whole movement look stupid or just absurd. But then on the other hand, we don't want to trust them. We have to look at them through a lens of, well, are these the good people telling us something or not? And that makes it very difficult for all of us, I think.
Well, my comment about just getting elected, I'm talking about Atlanta, and I'm pretty familiar with the mayor of Atlanta. So that was, I realize there are some people out there who know things and everything. So I was talking about a very specific case in this instance. But what I guess the last thing I would finish up with is I've had a bunch of people that listen to me from Washington State talk about how they're going to mandatory vaccines up there. And it's scaring the crap out of a lot of people because, you know, no matter where you stand on vaccines as a libertarian, I would think that most libertarians and especially anarchists would be like, well, that's just a choice that person, you know, should make a choice is what they should put in their body. I mean, how could within the state something like, you know, nullification be used to, you know, stop this?
What do you think?
I can just add briefly. In general, the concept and the strategies that are used for nullification, at least how we use it in modern times, not participating in the enforcement, refusal to cooperate, civil disobedience in many ways, these are generally crafted specifically for states and their political subdivisions, cities, and other localities in response to the federal government. Because of the nature of the federal constitution being a compact, the federal government is a creature of the people of the several states. Now, the states are different. The localities are political subdivisions and creations of the state. And in some areas, like the state government can kick out a sheriff. They can dissolve local governments if they want to. So you can't use the same strategies that in general. But on a state level, it really gets down to if people don't like it, it's not going to be easy. But if people don't like what the states are doing, it's going to take mass civil disobedience. There is no legal approach like, oh, the local government's going to say, well, we're not going to comply with this. Well, maybe they can get away with it if the state government is too busy doing other stuff. But if they just want to be able to say that and have it work in law, they're going to have a very hard time.
Say the federal government's answer to this whole coronavirus thing is, oh, we have this vaccine and everybody has to take it. Well, then now you're in a situation where, you know, states, localities could fight back against that. From what you've seen in the past, what's the best way to do that?
Well, if people are going to do that, they're literally going to have to start at a local level and not participate because the CDC doesn't have an army to be able to do this. I guess it depends on how the feds want to enforce it. In general, health mandates, environmental mandates, gun control measures, it's put out there by the federal government. It's directed by a handful of people in Washington, D.C. in each situation, and almost all the enforcement action happens on a state or a local level, either state regulatory agency, for example, with the environment, or local. Even now, when it comes to vaccines, a lot of the state-level mandates are basically following CDC guidelines. So if the CDC comes out and starts doing mandates, that's a whole other story. Again, it's going to have to be implemented on a state level. So will the people want to resist that? I'm sure there's enough. Personally, I think I would just try to hide out in my apartment as long as possible until things blow over, but we'll see how it goes.
Any ideas on that, Tom?
Well, I'm just glad Michael's in charge of the 10th Amendment Center. I like to be the theorist who explains why you're all justified in doing this. But in terms of when and how exactly to implement it, oh, I am so not your person. Oh. But that is so Michael's wheelhouse.
But well, okay.
So that's why we're such a good team, man. I mean,
well, theoretically, why should people be able to, you know, people are going to argue for, you know, and I just brought up vaccines because that's another thing that's in the news. You know, people are saying, oh, well, when are they going to come out with a vaccine for this? What's the theory behind, you know, people say, oh, well, if you don't get it, you're not allowed to go out in public. Things like, what would be, how would you construct an argument against that?
I don't know. I don't know. Jeez, I'm going to, no matter what I say, somebody's coming down on me.
I know what direction to go in with it, but you are right. Maybe
I'm actually interested in what either you guys have to say on a philosophical level, because that's where I'm always definitely lacking. Because I'm my initial gut instinct is government force equals bad. So
right, but I don't. The thing is, let's say, because the reason you can't have a discussion about this is that it turns into a pro-vaccine versus anti-vaccine conversation.
Yeah.
Now, well, the point of a philosophical discussion is not to get into the scientific minutiae. That makes it not a philosophical discussion. A philosophical discussion would say, let's stipulate for the sake of argument that the vaccine is 100% effective and has no side effects. Okay, that's how you have a philosophical argument. So let's abstract from potential problems with the vaccine, and let's say that it's only positive. So then the question becomes, you either do this or there is some possibility that you could inadvertently kill someone. Now, let's say instead of being susceptible to this coronavirus, instead, every single time you leave your house, you walk around wielding knives in a way that you're bound to hurt somebody. Like you're bound to hurt somebody. And they say, well, look, if there's no way we can get the knives out of your hands, you can't leave your house. We would be more likely to say, well, yeah, if somebody's going around doing that, then yeah, he probably shouldn't be able to leave his house. But you're probably not going to kill every single person in your path, but you might inadvertently kill one or two. How is that not the same thing as going around and potentially infecting people with something deadly? I mean, I'm trying to work through this on a theoretical level. So I don't want to get emails from people saying, oh, Woods, you're just – would you shut up for 5 minutes and be a human?
Oh, yeah. We all know, Tom, you've been working for the CDC all along.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then I'll be accused of I'm collecting my paycheck from the CDC. They don't know my address. I never get the paycheck from the Koch brothers and all the people I'm supposed to be working for.
I do appreciate what you said, though, Tom, because, yeah, I don't want you to get in trouble. So, okay.
Well, but, I mean, honestly, look, I don't want to. It's not like I'm saying that I'm a coward and I don't dare say what I really think. It's just more like, do I want the trouble of dealing with all this? But I'm talking about forget the vaccine issue for a second and just look at it from a libertarian standpoint. If you're doing something that has at least a moderate risk of harming somebody else, and there's a way to stop yourself from doing it and you don't do it, do we just say, oh, that doesn't matter? I mean, really, is that how libertarian theory looks at this? That doesn't matter? I don't know.
No, that makes a lot of sense. It really does. I mean, and that comes back to
private property, right?
Well, what should be the basis is self-responsibility too. You know, just being able, self-ownership to, and knowing, and the non-aggression principle. I mean, it comes down to non-aggression principle. I mean, the non-aggression principle doesn't have to be punching someone in the face. It could also be not infecting somebody with something, you know, that could potentially kill them. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And just one quick thought on that again, too. And again, if we're thinking in theory and we're talking about a private property society, let's say there's a private property city. If you're driving like an idiot doing donuts or something like that, they'll probably kick you out at some point. There would be stipulation that you wouldn't be allowed to live there if you didn't follow certain safety practices.
Exactly.
So we can acknowledge that. And obviously, we don't live in that society, so it creates all kinds of other questions. We, of course, want to support it from a private property perspective. But since we don't have that, what is the expectation? I don't have an answer.
The tragedy of the commons, man. That's one of the toughest ones to deal with, really is. But I promised about 45 minutes, and I really appreciate you guys. Plug away. You want to go first, Tom?
Yeah, sure. Of course, like Pete, I'm a podcaster. I've got the Tom Woods Show, which I do every weekday. But I guess right now, I'm trying to think of all the free ebooks I give away, which one would be the best right now? And maybe my ebook, AOC is Wrong, is the one that needs to be written, because it looks like some of her ideas are about to be implemented under the pressure of this crisis. They're gonna give away free this and prohibit that and whatever. So it might be a good idea to bone up on the arguments against them. You think, oh, I already know all the arguments against AOC. Really? You know all the numbers and all the facts and figures necessary to steamroll these things? I don't think so. I need to brush up on them from time to time. So AOCiswrong.com is a fun place to go, because not only do you get this free ebook, but you have the distinct pleasure of typing in AOCiswrong.com. I mean, that's amazing. I can't believe that was available. And I'll just say, I've known it's taking too long, but I bought that domain before they started calling her AOC. They were still just calling her Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I bought AOCiswrong.com because I thought, well, OcasioCortezIsWrong.com is too long. So I just said, well, we'll do AOC. And then they started calling her AOC. You know, and that domain cost me like $10. You know, maybe it would have cost $1,000 after they started calling her that, but I got it really soon. So sometimes you take a gamble and you come out smelling like roses.
Awesome. Michael?
Well, since that story was so incredibly awesome, the one thing I want to plug is AOCIsWrong.com, because that was just amazing.
I want to plug the 10th Amendment Center.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to plug it.
No, you guys, and I'm very grateful for that. But that was, Tom, that was a really cool story, especially about the AOC and the domain name purchase, because that's a good business in and of itself. If you guys want a good starting point for the 10th Amendment Center, I think 10thamendmentcenter.com/report. It's basically a free ebook. It's an 80-page annual download that we do. The first half of it talks about the history, the philosophical basis, the constitutional basis behind nullification. The second half is how it's being implemented in the states and local communities today on various issues, from weed to healthcare to surveillance, gun control, and the Federal Reserve. This coming year, which we're going to release, well, for 2019, we're going to be releasing probably in the next month or so, we'll be covering things like foreign policy and war as well, too.
Well, I want to say I think both of you guys are heroes. I support both of you guys, you know, monetarily, because I think the work that you guys do is just way too important. And Michael, I think that the way the 10th Amendment Center is set up and nullification and secession, getting things down as small as possible, is really the only way forward. And Tom helped me to understand economics by writing Meltdown. I mean, that was my introduction to economics. So, yeah, both of you guys, I really appreciate you both. And I know we didn't stay on topic some, because there was some topical stuff that I thought I wouldn't want to work into this, but I do appreciate your time and you guys for putting up with me.
Thanks, Pete. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. That was awesome. Really appreciate it.
All right, folks. I have been writing about the virus from one aspect or another in my newsletter, which all the fun people subscribe to. And it's a great way to break up your day, reading old Woods here. How do you hop on that list and be one of the people, one of the cream of the crop in the world? The answer is by getting one of my free ebooks. And how about this one today? This one, The Deregulation Boogeyman. Because now that we're obviously going to be hitting some economic hard times, we've had the same discussion coming up about the previous one, that, oh my goodness, the last time we had a big economic crisis, this was because there wasn't enough government oversight. You have to help me free the world of this. You have to help me. And the way you can do that is by reading my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman. And you can pick that up for nothing over at regulationmyths.com. So that is what you should be doing while you are confined to your home this weekend. Go read The Deregulation Boogeyman for free. Download it at regulationmyths.com. We'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.